everybody. I am Ted King, professional cyclist and sometimes semi-professional baker.
Hi, everyone. I am Laura King. I am a sometimes gravel pro cyclist and sometimes interior design guru.
Yes, and Stu Streeter here, age group cyclist and recent finisher of a 100-mile bike ride.
Ooh.
I know, right? Hey, Ted, tell us about this baking prowess.
I feel like, especially this time of year, when it's a little bit cool out, when there's snow on the ground, but the reality is it is year-round, I like to bake mostly pumpkin bread. I'll sometimes make banana bread, but I like nothing more than waking up and having a coffee and a slice of pumpkin bread, and every recipe is a little bit different, so I iterate on it. I don't actually have a recipe. It's all up in my head. So, yeah, that's my aspiring dream. Laura, what do you got? You are a sometimes interior designer? Go on.
Oh, I've just been running point with our contractor on the latest projects we have going on in our home, which is really fun. I've realized I have a little bit of a interest and passion in it, and it also coincidentally takes up more time than I ever realized. So whether it's like purchasing for this, we're building a ADU apartment, whether it's purchasing whatever, the lights or bathroom vanities, or looking at a space and measuring it out and figuring out what the best layout will be or how we're going to bring more light into this space, blah, blah, blah. I've just been learning a lot and coordinating a lot of deliveries and
Pinterest. Is Pinterest still a thing?
Using a lot of Pinterest.
Or am I dating myself? Oh, that's a still thing.
It
good.
Is. It's all very right. Useful.
Good. I feel hip. I know that.
Apparently, Ted's not very involved in the design.
I'm the.
It works best this way.
I'm the live-in recipient of the benefits of her aesthetic uplifting of the house. It's great. I love it.
How about you, Stu?
A recent 100-mile bike ride finisher. I was in Orlando for work last week and took advantage of a day kind of off and very flat roads and warm temps and got 100 in, which was really great for, you know, a guy like me. It was very, very fun and also long. And I looked for a shortcut at like the 65-mile mark where I went, I'm barely over halfway. I don't want to, I'm done. I'm over it. Mm-hmm. And looked on my Garmin to try and find a shortcut back. And it kept erroring on trying to redirect me. And so I was stuck. And it was a great gift because I did all 101 miles. So was, getting was closer to ready.
When you set out, the goal was 100. And then you got a little wayward in the middle. But you made it.
Exactly.
Okay. That's awesome.
Exactly. I really wanted to do over 100 because I've got that 200-mile thing coming up later on and really needed to get over that threshold mentally. I just needed to suffer through 100 here in the spring. So
that's excellent. Yay. Congrats. Well done. Very well done.
Thanks.
Yeah. Congratulations.
Yeah. Well, felt good.
I want to welcome everyone. If you're a new listener, welcome to the Gravel Kings podcast. If you have listened to our first two podcasts and come back, we thank you. We appreciate any and all feedback, and we've gotten some positive feedback so far, so we really appreciate that. But we also don't mind constructive feedback. So just always remember you can email us and be in touch with us and let us know what you want to hear or what would be helpful or what might help equip you on your journey to becoming a part of the gravel family and part of gravel cycling. So as we were kind of talking about our last weeks, we decided that maybe the theme of this podcast today is kind of the travel edition, because we have all been on the road.
Truth.
Maybe Stu, we'll start with you. You just mentioned you were in Orlando, but tell us a little bit about what you were doing there, how long you were there, and maybe I think the first thing we wanted to jump into is just like traveling while integrating, bringing your bike and trying to ride, and some of the tips and tricks that we've all learned along the way, or anything that we can share that might help our fellow listeners take their bikes along their trips as well.
Yeah, as you guys know, I travel with my bike almost every week when I'm on the road. So it's something I'm pretty familiar with by now, and always going to new places. I was in Orlando last week, and as you've heard me complain 100 times over, I just can't handle the bad weather. And Northern California has been like nothing but rain since January, it feels like. And even a little colder than normal. So I was just in a bad California space. We're just such wimps. So going to Orlando, knowing it would be sunny, was really, really wonderful. And got 80 degrees and sunny and a little tan line and a little sun on my face. So it was just awesome, awesome, awesome. That was great, great fun. You know, I think for like travel stuff, I'm trying to think of stuff that maybe not everybody would think of. And so for me, there's a couple of things that might be seem random, but they're really simple, no matter if you're traveling with your bike once a year or often. And first one for me is a frame pump. It seems like frame pumps like went the way of the dodo bird, and we all have CO2s and we all have these little tiny mini pumps that are, you know, are great and fine in a pinch. But having a frame pump if you're flying on an airplane is so key, because often I'm getting in late at night and then I want to sneak in a ride that evening, or I want to ride the next morning and I don't have time to get to a bike shop and go buy a CO2. Listeners, do not try to sneak a CO2 in your airline case. You may think you sneak things in your airline case all the time that are illegal to take. Don't mess with that one. I'm telling you, it goes real ugly. Anybody have any experiences with that? That they want to talk about, right?
I was banned from TSA for a year because of my three strikes.
Three strikes?
They were accidental.
You had a third strike?
I did.
Come on.
I got a really formal letter in the mail that made me feel like I was a total criminal.
No, one is trying to sneak it by you. Two is an accident. Three is not an accident.
Well, it was like 7 years ago, so.
Okay.
Zero strikes since then. I learned my lesson.
So you inspired me in that, because you told me that story, I don't know, a year or two ago about losing your TSA free. And I thought, I'm not going to lose my global entry on a CO2. So anyway, frame pump. I just think a frame pump is great because you can actually get good pressure and then it's on your bike and just leave it in the case and it's small. And so carry a frame pump. I think that's really, really helpful. Two, bring extra sealant. I don't know about every brand, and I do kind of use one brand of sealant, so maybe that brand just does it. But I find that the airplane sucks up sealant and dries it out really, really fast. And so carry the little extras, and that way you can top it off when you land, especially if you're going for an event, and you throw new tires on or fresh tires before you fly. I don't even put sealant in and then fly the bike, and then I just hit a couple single-use sealants in there. I think that's key. And then the last one that I will say that I think has been really helpful to me is throw a little cheap hose nozzle in your airline case. Because everywhere I go every week, I can always find a hose at the hotel I'm staying at, around back or, you know, on the side.
Oh, wow.
And if I have a little cheapy dollar hose nozzle, I can spray the hose, I can thread that on there and I can get some pressure and actually wash my bike properly. And it's small and it just goes in there. It takes up less space than my chain loop. So
what length are you working with? A foot?
What do you mean?
Like when you say a hose nozzle, you're talking about.
It's a little adapter.
No, I just mean like the little, you know, just the squirt piece, just the piece that threads onto the end of the hose, just to sprayer. Because sometimes there's like hoses at the hotel, but they're like for watering plants or whatever, and they don't have a tip on it. And so I just use the little, you know, spray tip.
Yeah, I guess I'm asking.
To wash your car.
Right, I misinterpreted that. I feel like more often than not, I'm at a place and I want to wash my bike and there's only a spigot. So there's not even a hose. I thought you were traveling with a hose and I was like, whoa, that is gangster.
No, that is awesome. No, I'm not traveling with a hose. But you can always get a hose because they have a maintenance closet at every hotel and they'll always let you borrow their
hose. That's true. If I'm going as far as asking for a maintenance closet, then I'm just taking my bike into my bath. Because, I mean, I'm also a minimum. I mean, I do appreciate packing all of the accessories, and I think that really do benefit and I'm not trying to take away from this thing, but like you're talking the equivalent of putting your thumb on the end of a hose to get like higher pressure. Is that right?
Right.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
That's a luxury. I like the way you think and the way you pack. I like that one, Stu. That's great.
All right. There you have it. So anyway, that was Orlando. But you guys just came back from like a trip of a lifetime, at least from my purview. I watched with incredible, loving, healthy envy. You want to share with the rest?
You know, the trip was amazing. And I'm not trying to sugarcoat it. I think you're right. Like, it is the kind of trip of a lifetime. I hosted a podcast earlier today, and I traditionally end my podcast with three questions, one of which is, where's the number one place you'd like to ride your bike you've never ridden? And Mallorca was the answer to this person's question. And yeah, I mean, this was a dream trip. It was a blessing. It was awesome. It was, by and large, perfect weather. We had two rainy days. One was the day we arrived and we snuck in a ride. And truth be told, despite hurricane force winds and a bomb cyclone hitting the Mediterranean, it was actually a really enjoyable ride. And the only other day it ride was on day four, which, okay, we were also there two trains, so we put in three big days, and the fourth day of rain was like, ah, perfect, we will rest today. What a fortuitous time to go to the spa. Great roads, great terrain, terrific group. It was tops. We loved it.
Yeah, I think you just mentioned a few kind of key components to what makes a real dream trip. And it's like people, a group of friends who are dear friends who we often don't get to see unless we are traveling, because since we all live spread across the country now. So seeing good friends who we have a great kind of, you know, you just fall into place in terms of riding style. And in fact, upon heading there, there was no itinerary from anyone, because I think we all had a trust that once we got there, we were all going to be in agreement on the plan of riding and what we wanted to do. So, you know, you mix that with a place that's honestly Disneyland for cycling. The cars and the people there are so accommodating to cyclists. You see hundreds of cyclists out on the road. The infrastructure is just there. So everything already there is in place for a cyclist to kind of be comfortable and happy. And then, you know, it's just really, we decided to stay at one central location where it was, we could just ride every day without having to drive, without having to move locations. And I just think we've done plenty of trips where we've moved around, but there's something, just the simplicity of staying in one place with access, good access to getting to a variety of terrain and rides is, I think, a key kind of formula for just, you know, this is a training camp, but it's also at a vacation, and you want it to feel like when you're not training, you can actually recover and relax. This place we stayed had a spa and cold plunge. I mean, this was a one off vacation for us without children, which was a huge gift. So like, just, I think a big takeaway for us is just like, wow, what recovery feels like when you don't have any other responsibilities, after training.
Yeah, it was a dream trip. It was incredible.
So back to kind of tips, Ted. I mean, you are the true guru, I think, when it comes, you've been doing this for over a decade, two decades.
Bike racing,
traveling with your bike, or not traveling with your bike, but getting to a place and immediately getting on your bike, mm-hmm. whether you had to travel with it or not. So I think you are the one who, packs both of our bikes. So thank you.
I was going to ask, what are the cool things that you try to sneak into your bike box?
No. I will not be dishonest to our listeners. But a lot of our packing is I'll get the kids stuff. When the kids are traveling with us, I take care of the kids packing and Ted takes care of the bikes, which I think is a great division of labor. but this is the Fairly first time accurate. we've traveled with AirTags.
Yeah. Around Christmas time, actually, no, sometime before Christmas. Actually, it was sometime way before Christmas. Hazel has a lion. Hazel has a stuffy lion. And, you know, it's the kind of thing that you lose 3 times a week. And it's like, oh, where is that thing? She needs to go to bed now. And, okay, truth be told, she's very resilient because as much as this thing is impossible to not be seen by her side, the one time it was lost in the Tupperware drawer for like 2 weeks, a considerable period of time, she was totally fine. But then when we found it, she's like... over the moon. So, AirTags. I was like, brilliant. We'll just buy some AirTags and put them in all sorts of important things, like the stuffy. Ironically, there is no AirTag in the stuffy because it occurred to me that I don't know how to invert the hem. You know, I don't want to slice it open and then have the seam of her stuffing sticking out. So in the meantime, we've done a great job not losing the stuffy. And we have 4 AirTags. One goes in each bike box, and one goes in each of our pieces of luggage. I don't know. I mean, I think we did well in terms of not having the airlines lose our luggage. We did have one of our friends have his bike arrive a day late. It's a great way to track luggage. It's a really, I think the airlines are having a hard time having customers come up and scream at them and point at their phone and say, see, my bike is here, my suitcase is here, because it's a really hard thing to prove and follow up on. But it's not going to be a detriment to make that, I forget what, $25 investment to have peace of mind to know where your bike is. Not least of which, in case your bike gets stolen. I mean, now they have all sorts of inconspicuous ways to hide it on your bike so that, say, you have it in your saddlebag and the thief steals the saddlebag, at least you know where the bike is. Some other important tricks. You know what? You don't want to arrive with a bent derailleur hanger, so I will often remove the derailleur. I then wrap it, the rear derailleur, into a cloth, and then I bind it to the chain stays so that that's not bouncing around and chipping your chain. I think it's honestly the kind of thing you want to practice, and if not practice disassembling your bike and box it up, at least do it far enough advanced, because it can be quite a headache if you're doing it for the first time right before travel. I think we also live in a crazy age of modern bikes with, you know, integrated internal routing and all sorts of stuff like that. There's a good friend and employee at Untappd who has this brand new bike that has internal routing, and he's asked me time and time again, are you sure you can take it apart and put it in a bike box? I'm like, yep, I promise you can do it. But yeah, I mean, I understand those hesitations. It's not an insignificant thing to take your bike apart and have the confidence to rebuild it back up.
Ted, I'm surprised to hear that you're taking the derailleur off, because you guys travel with hard cases, right?
We do.
That's a good tip for the right, because I travel with a soft case.
Yep.
And so it makes a lot of sense for me to pull my derailleur off, because, you know, that part, I've got a little bar there that guards it, but I pull mine. But I'm kind of surprised to hear that with a hard case you're doing that too. I'm sure that's right, and I just never thought of it. Talk us through that for the average traveler.
I mean, every case you're going to disassemble the bike a different way. And so whether it's even, you know, it's not as binary as hard case or soft case. Every bike case you're going to disassemble a different way. I just have more peace of mind when I take it off. If I leave it on, then you taco the bike back together, taco the bike case back together, rather. I think you could be applying enough pressure on the side, given our particular case, to bend the derailleur hanger. I don't know. It's simple enough to use the 5mm and remove it and put it back on. So
yeah,
I'm confident in that.
Sure. No, that's really helpful.
Yeah.
What about jet lag? Do you have any? What are your top tips? Well,
all the coffee.
I'll interject first and say, I'm someone who struggles on long flights. Internationally, I don't sleep on planes. So I just, and when I don't sleep, I am.
That's an important point. Like,
very unhappy.
She's being literal. Laura does not sleep on airplanes. And I didn't know such a thing existed. Like, I thought you could, like, close your eyes and, okay, in a long haul flight, maybe you only sleep for like an hour. No. Laura is allergic to sleeping when she gets on an airplane, which is fascinating, but it's like this reality that I've learned, and therefore...
I think it's also sometimes mental, because I've had this issue not being able to sleep, so I just get on the plane assuming I'm not going to be able to sleep, and I think it, you know, kind of perpetuates itself. Anyway, consequently, I arrive at our destination feeling pretty wrecked, and honestly, like... really dreading these long haul flights, because I just feel so terrible. And then I feel like trying to stay up most of the day, I pretty much feel like I reach a hallucinating state near the end of the day. So that's always been pretty challenging for me. I do feel like I got a little more rest, whether I slept or not, I don't know, but this flight. And then upon arriving, Ted kind of, we got motivated despite the weather to get out for a spin. And I have to say, that was the last thing I felt like doing, especially with the weather. But it was probably one of the best things we did, just to get that fresh air, to pass the time, honestly, because the passing of time for me on that day feels like slow motion. Cause I would just want to go to sleep. So I realize it's a lot to pack into a day, and, there's often a lot of moving parts, just making sure you even get with your bike and your luggage to your hotel and get situated. But if you're able to just get out for a little spin, we just went out for 1 hour. It just was a total game changer, and I think helped us kind of our bodies settle in a little more easier than normal.
Yeah, I feel like exercising puts you back on the local time zone. So, sure, even though you haven't really slept normally, and at that point, whatever, 24 hours, 24 plus, you get out for a ride, in this particular case, in the afternoon, and then you're in the routine that you'd normally otherwise be in. Sure, you're sleepy, but you finish the ride, you take a shower, you look at the clock, you say, oh, it's dinner time. And you probably would have otherwise gone to bed 2 hours ago, at least this way. Yeah, you're actually quite hungry. You have dinner and you go to bed super exhausted, and traditionally... sleep quite well. I mean, I am not going to deny that I drink a lot of coffee, and I think coffee is a tremendous addition to international travel.
Well, and on that note, maybe your tips, right? Like
all of it.
Well, and we never arrive without our own coffee prep setup.
Yeah, so I had this conversation recently, all of the different coffee making devices that I've had in my career, because I remember even from my first year, I had this electric mocha pot, M-O-K-A, the like very old school Italian mocha pots, but I had an electric one, so you could plug it in. It was awesome. And we moved on to a variety of different machines since then, currently landing very squarely on AeroPresses as our mode of coffee. A heads up, you also don't want to get the wrong electric outlet converter, or you do want to have the correct outlet converter, because Europeans are on a 240 system and we're on 120 here in the US, which was a real horror story. Once upon a time, my first year going to Girona, I bought an American coffee maker, because for some reason I didn't think that Europeans were going to have coffee. I thought they only drank espresso and that was it. So I bought this like 4-cup, you know, mini American drip coffee machine. And I get over there and I set it up in the morning and I plug it in and I'm on the computer or something and I smell something's burning. And then it has that terrible electric burning smell. And I go back in the kitchen and literally the coffee maker is smoking. And I'm just like, oh, what a devastating start to the day and my career and the season. And like, okay, turns out they sell coffee makers in Europe also. But... little things like that. Yeah. I mean, having a tried and true system.
I mean, we even traveled with our full size mugs because we don't like the espresso size mugs in the hotel room. We want a full cup of coffee.
Yes, I do feel proud of making that decision once upon a time and saying, yeah, we need to have our own mugs.
The coffee setup is
you?
Key.
What, do you have a coffee setup?
Yeah.
What's your system?
Yeah, I travel. Same thing. I travel. I have a little silicone fold down, like almost a backpacking pour over.
Yep.
And it just, it folds totally flat. I can throw it in my backpack if I need to. And then I have a little silicone collapsible tea kettle as well that plugs in. And, you know, if I'm traveling internationally, I've got my converter. But that little silicone tea kettle folds down pretty small, like maybe 2 inches tall. And then I can do a pour over. And then at night, especially if I'm in a weird time zone, I can drink hot tea. I will, like I did, in fact, today for today's ride, I can boil hot water in my hotel room and then pour it in my coffee travel thing, just hot water. And then I have water to wash off with after my ride. So it's just like, it crosses so many intersections for me of travel, but yeah, that's my setup. And, I just don't understand people who travel and don't travel with their coffee setup. It's so easy to take, you know?
And such a disappointment when you don't, when you realize what you might have to make it through the morning with.
Yeah. Especially if you're in like, you know, insert name of town that is known for terrible coffee and, you know, the hotel coffee is just awful there. It's like, yeah. So I'm with you. I always travel with my own coffee setup.
Any acclimating to time zone or jet lag tips that you have?
You know, I don't know if it's, I don't know if it's all that special other than I just try to get on time zone on the travel day. So, you know, for example, last week I flew from California to Orlando. It's not a huge time difference, but 3 hours, you still feel it. And so I just got on time the day before, and the day before I was working in my home office. And so I just got up at 4 a.m. that day and pounded out emails and did my thing. Because then I can be tired there. And then the next day, I had an early flight. So I was up at like 3 a.m. So by the time I arrived in Florida, I was kind of already set on time. And I'd been really productive the two prior days. So I just usually try to get on time ahead. Because I'd rather be exhausted on the airplane. Now, I'm different than you, Laura, in that I can be asleep immediately when I get on the airplane. And I get settled in, and before the airplane even tips back to start to climb, I'm out. And then I don't wake up till the first, you know, soda pop, water service, trays come through. So I can always take a quick nap on an airplane. I'm sorry. I can take a quick nap almost any time sitting upright. Just count me down from 10.
Jen, skill.
I know it, and I've been like that forever. Like, Jen will come in and we'll be going out to dinner and it'll be 5 o'clock at night. And I'll say, babe, how long till you're ready to go? And she'll glare at me because she knows what that means. And she goes, 20 minutes. And I go, great. I'm going to take a 10 minute doze is what we call it. And I can lay down on the couch immediately. I can nap for 10 minutes, wake up totally refreshed. All right, let's go out to dinner. I feel great. Amazing. So I feel she does not love that.
I feel like, Ted, you can do that too. You just choose not to most of the time.
I can't fall asleep exactly that quickly, but I mean, the value of that is incredible. Even just laying down and closing your eyes, I think for 10 minutes is awesome. Apologies for being so hoarse. I mean, actually, on that topic, I think that is a detriment of travel. We have been on the go since... Today is Tuesday. I'm going to struggle through this sentence even talking because I'm getting so hoarse. We started traveling home from Spain on Thursday last week. And then I went straight to a race in Texas. In the final few days of Spain, I was sort of nursing a head cold. And it was tremendously mild. The day of travel, in order to go from east to west, from Europe to North America, it presents a very long day because you're going to travel all day and then it ends up being like a 30-hour day. It was that day and in so many plane rides that my cold just blew up and I'm still recovering from that. And I also had a bike race in there, so.
And another, how many?
Oh, then I had a monster trip home.
Terrible day of travel back home.
The day after the race, Yeah, woe is me. I mean, I hate complaining because I'm like, I'm complaining about going to bike races. But yeah, I mean, it's the kind of thing you do want to go well and will be in your benefit when it does go well. I was supposed to get home at 4 p.m. on Sunday and ended up getting in at 1 a.m. on Monday. But truth be told, it was sort of a miracle that I got in at all on Monday. So I'm happy with that.
I heard you had to run across the airport. How was your splits?
They were strong. They were really strong, and I really crushed the competition, and that's what's important.
That is what's important. Did you get a Strava? Have you seen these people in airports with getting Strava segments in the airport, and they're sprinting them?
Dude, I would be top of the leaderboard given this particular segment. I mean, it was this particular segment is Washington Reagan Airport D51 to C29. I said it was a mile and a half. I think it's a mile and a half because it took me about 10 minutes at full sprint pace with a backpack on. And my competition, admittedly, was a family of four with two little kids and another family of four with two little kids. And, I mean, the punchline is the gate agent in the D gate said, hey, there is another flight. At this point, we're 8 hours late. There's another flight at C29. If you can make it over before they close the door. And I was like, let's go. And so this group of nine of us made it over. And I valiantly arrived at the new gate, having crushed the competition, and said, first, you cannot close the door. There are other people coming. And we all made it.
So you didn't put them in the barriers and take off.
No, I didn't Heisman them and say, get out of my way, kids. No, it was, we had misery loves company. We had a really good crew.
On that note,
I'm going to go get myself a glass of water.
Well, I think we've just talked about how we can maybe have some ways to simplify travel. Are there any that we missed? Do we want to talk about route planning? I think we've maybe touched on that once before, but
yeah, I think we have once before. I just say make way more routes than you think you'll use. Especially for those of us who are weekend warrior amateur cyclists. I think, at least for me, when I'm making my route and thinking I'm going to said city, and I make my 40-mile route, and I go, oh, it's going to be a great, 40-mile ride. And then you get there, and you're exhausted, or, a work meeting goes long, and it's like, I don't have time for a 40-hour route or 40-mile route. So just having lots of options, and building routes where you have a bailout to cut off can be really helpful. I just usually build way more routes than I think I'll use, and that has served me really, really well. Especially because I'm horrible with directions. Like, there is nobody on earth with sight who is worse at directions than me. I've left my hotel room twice today and walked all the way down the hall the wrong way. That's real news because I'm that bad at directions. So having lots of routes is really helpful for me because I really need, especially if I'm in a new city, if there's not mountains, I'm lost. So,
well, speaking of mountains, do you think we had a key learning with one of our routes the main day that you created that?
You seem to have an answer to the question that you're asking.
Well, there's only was there one day in Mallorca that went semi-poorly?
No. They were all awesome.
Where we all feared for our life because we were so cold.
What does that have to do with routing? It was cold. We all dressed poorly.
What I think it has to do with routing is I failed to study the map, right? I see the mileage. I see the elevation gain. Great. No problem. We had a really nice sunny day, riding just kind of not mountainous terrain, but rolling terrain the day prior. So we all dressed optimistically. And I didn't realize we were riding up over 3,000 feet where it just happened to be semi-socked in that day. Pretty much we were in a cloud and it was misting. The temperature dropped to 38 degrees Celsius. Fahrenheit. And we had a good...
It would have been hot.
I don't... What do you want to call it, that the time of that descent? 20 minutes of descending? And... Sure. We were not, none of us were dressed appropriately. No jacket. Well, one of us was, but yeah, she still froze. She runs different temperature wise than we do, but no jacket, no gloves. And I mean, we can kind of make light of it now, but I think many of us on that descent were actually like quite terrified. And, I mean, I was shaking so badly that my bike was just shuddering the entire time. I was trying to just hold my bike steady down the descent. It was a million switchbacks. We were all kind of fending for ourselves. At that point, my ETAP battery somehow, I don't know if it dislodged a little bit. For whatever reason, I thought it was dead, so I had to pull over and swap it. And it wasn't dead, but the main point was having to stop in that state was even more dangerous, as Ted was doing jumping jacks on the side of the road to try and help me, and we couldn't even open the rear saddlebag because my hands were so frozen. So, long story short, we made it to the bottom into a town. We got into a cafe where we were then like gifted blankets and jackets. I think the proprietor there she just looked at us and knew we needed help. I needed help. I was shaking uncontrollably.
I think they've also seen plenty of people do this exact thing. Like, they were not unaccustomed to seeing people freezing. They had an abundance of jackets and blankets for their guests.
Yeah. So my takeaway, you know what? When you're traveling and you don't have a SAG, put a few extra things in your back pockets that you know, just in case. That might seem really obvious and simple, but, you know, we've been riding for a really long time and we just were so excited to see that the sun and the high of the temperature there was 65 and sunny. We were like, why would I need a jacket? It's going to be great. So that's my other.
Yeah, I get that.
That's not a routing issue.
And you know what?
That was great.
Well, it was a failing to study the route issue. I didn't study the fact that we would go up 3,000 feet.
Right.
And think about what the weather would mean with that.
And I get made fun of a lot, but I have for years, anytime I'm doing anything I don't know real well, I get one of those express mail envelopes from U.S. Postal Service. Sorry, post office. And I just throw them in my gear bag and then I just wad them up so that they're not loud. And I can stash that up my jersey like the old school newspaper guys because it's waterproof and it's that Tyvek material and it takes up no space in my back pocket. So I almost always have one in my back pocket if I'm anywhere that I don't know what the weather will do because those things work really, really well. That's been a really helpful one.
Yeah, I like it. I'm gonna
That's crazy talk.
I'm going to do that.
That's like the modern 1940s.
Right.
I applaud that. That's a great one. I mean, unintentionally a sponsor plug, Velocio makes a amazing, I think it's called ultralight jacket that basically balls up into a golf ball and a half. And that thing is tremendous. It's largely windproof. I mean, it's not waterproof, but man, the protection you get, it would have been the perfect jacket for this particular day. Yeah, just very poor foresight or very poor looking east. Sorry, west rather, from where we were starting. Actually, no, we saw these massive ominous clouds. And as soon as we left, we're like, oh, I guess we're going right into that. So yeah, it was just sort of, it was optimism on our part, just assuming that everything was sunshine and cinnamon. And it turned out to be colder and less cinnamony. Anyway, I mean, go full circle to the conversation about route planning. I agree, having options is a great idea. I love mapping and I love routing. And if you are averse to that, I generally map with, ride with GPS, and there's some really good auto-generate route options. I mean, you toggle the distance you want or the time you want and the terrain you want, even down to like the terra firma type. Do you want paved? Do you want mixed terrain? Do you want gravel? And it'll see what have been popularly ridden in your area and create routes for you. Want to say Strava creates a similar one, but I think Ride with GPS is awesome. And furthermore, heat maps. See what other people have ridden and then do that homework that I just mentioned Ride with GPS can automatically do for you.
One of the days we were riding, you said we were on these secret side roads because it was Wout's route. Did you just take that from Strava?
Yeah, I'd previously read some sometime this spring, in Wout's lead up to crushing the classics, which he appears to be on pace to do. The article, I mean, talk about riveting news on cycling news. It was, Wout does a 7-hour ride. And I was like, ah, cool. I mean, that happened to be lodged in my mind from weeks prior. And so I looked up what the route was, and the island is small enough that we could overlap a good portion of it. And yeah, it was a great route. Wout route. Hot route. Wout route. I don't know. I think we probably covered, I mean, we started in different places, but I think we overlapped for a good 60 miles of it. It was great. I think I took most of his crowns. Just kidding.
I'm even more envious now than I was before of your Mallorca trip. Man, I want to go. Looked awesome.
It was neat. It was really neat.
Well, that kind of is a good segue into, I think, riding with other people can go really well or really poorly, depending on expectations and, you know, just like the riding prowess and how disparate it is amidst the group. And I would say that's one thing that I think we did quite well at. And maybe we could share some of our kind of learned tips, just with how to ride with a group of differing abilities and how to ride with your partner, et cetera, et cetera. Oh, but before we go into that, I must bring up one of the questions that came in. I thought it might be worth addressing because someone said, hey, what are your cycling backgrounds? Said, out of ignorance, I'm simply unaware. What cycling background does Stu have? What cycling background does Laura have? So maybe we just quickly in 60 seconds or slightly more, give our cycling background. Do you want to kick it off, Stu?
Sure. Yeah, I'm really started at BMX. I was a motocross kid that left motocross when I was young and moved to BMX and kind of went BMX to downhill and dual slalom and then cross country mountain bikes and then raced on the road. Was a very mediocre Cat 2 on the road. And now I'm just an old guy, age group, gravel dude.
That was good. That was 60 seconds or less. Laura, what do you got? 60 seconds or less.
My background is, well, first and foremost, swimming. That swimming took me into triathlon for 12 years of triathlon of all different distances where I qualified for my elite card, but ended up kind of being burned out and not pursuing triathlon as a pro. And then just kind of found, realized I had an affinity for just riding and that it was also kind of taking the complexity out of three sports into one. And I attended a USA Cycling Talent ID camp and explored kind of what it would look like to pursue cycling as a professional on the road. And ultimately at that point was also offered a really great move in my career and chose career over kind of what I saw as like the lonely, very challenging lifestyle of a female cycling professional on the road. But I've been lucky to work in the industry for over a decade now and combine riding still at an elite level as I wish without pressure, which I feel like is a good situation for me and my personality of just like loving the sport but not having the pressure of needing to perform for my income.
Self-inflicted pressure.
Sorry. Oh, completely self-inflicted pressure. Yeah. And when I line up, I care a lot. And, you know, that's the nice thing about just trying to balance your life with diversifying life with not just racing. I love to race, but I need to have other pursuits that kind of, takes all the focus. Help me to not place all my focus on the performance aspect. And that helps me a lot. Thankfully, these days, there are plenty of other things with having kids and job and home and balancing a partner who also is pursuing high level of cycling. And so I think we've found a good kind of middle ground. I found a good middle ground, I guess, for how to make that work. How about you? We all know who you are, but...
I'll be quick. I got into cycling in college, courtesy of my older brother. Pardon me as I clear my nasal passages. I grew up playing traditional American sports. Hockey was my favorite sport as a kid. Goalie for the soccer team. Played tennis. I mean, I'm definitely a stick and ball sport kind of guy. And then I sort of fell into cycling at a time transitioning in college when I was figuring out what I wanted to do with academics and athletics and whatever. And yeah, just ran with it, so to speak, in college. Raced for the U.S. national team, U23 team in college a little bit, and then that segued to the first domestic pro team, 2006. I raced 3 years domestically and then made the leap to Europe and raced 7 years in the what's now called World Tour. And then I stopped doing that at the end of 2015 with the anticipation to stop racing. And that was just the beginning of contemporary gravel. Obviously, gravel pre-exists that by some indefinite period of time, but it was really fortuitous. I was the first guy from the World Tour into gravel, and I mean, I did, at that point, Dirty Kansas, now Unbound, on a whim in 2016, and that really lit up the future. So, here we are. Crazy. I did 10 years professional racing, and here I am in my ninth year of gravel racing, which is nuts. Which is fascinating to fit it all in, and I'm only 27 years old.
Yeah, all that before 27. Yeah. I like how you said I did Dirty Kansas, now known as Unbound, but we kind of left out one key detail.
What, I did it again?
You won it?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, I won it. Well, I won it again.
Oh, yeah, I won. No big deal.
Five?
I've done five traditional 200s. I did, ironically, not even 200 miles of the 350-mile XL. And I'm excited to go back this year with a newfound energy and enthusiasm.
Are you doing, or are you saying what you're doing this year at Unbound?
I'm racing the 200.
You are doing the 200. Okay.
Hell bent for glory.
If Unbound people are listening, shameless Stu plug, please let me into your bike race. I've tried for 3 years. Please let me into your bike race.
They say 3 years a term.
All right. We got to pull it back to, maybe we just kick this off with, like, why ride in a group in the first place? I think some of the major benefits are you can ride with cyclists of differing abilities and have it, you know, unlike running, like, actually work really well, especially if you are honest with kind of where you are in the mix and allow the strongest people to kind of sit at the front, take the wind, and you know, if you are not one of the strongest, to benefit from the draft. I think I've had a lot of practice in this, so sitting on the wheel of Ted many a time, and I think the way that we, on a trip like this, having a few riders who are kind of more serious racing and on a training plan, and then a few who are kind of semi-serious and adaptable to somebody else's training plan, or in a few who just kind of want to hang on, we were able to make it all work. And when you can find that kind of sweet spot, I think that can be the recipe, I guess, for a really successful week of bike riding. But I think maybe, Ted, do you want to mention a few of the things that you think lend themselves to making that a smooth process?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think what you were just saying, to fit it all together, right, this puzzle, begins with, it's like a relationship. It's like working with your spouse. Like, it begins, a successful relationship is going to work with communication. And so, what, we had, call it between 7 and 8 people on this particular trip riding. And a good mix of just along for the ride, trying to gain a little bit of fitness, and people who are trying to do a training program. And as the person who was doing the training program, I tried to make a distinct point of saying, okay, this is what I'm doing. I want everybody to feel comfortable to choose what they're going to do. And offering that up, I mean, you know, saying it the day before, hey, here's the route I'm thinking of, or here's another route that I'm thinking of, and putting it out to a vote. You know, are people thinking, we got 5 hours, do you want to do a hillier ride or do you want to do a flatter ride? And then also not being hell-bent for, I need to do this exact thing. Being able to be fluid is really important, and to allow opportunity to have something come up, right? I mean, if someone gets a flat and you got to stop on the side of the road for 5, 10, 15 minutes, well, don't let that send you into a tizzy. Taking a bigger step back, I think the art of riding in a group ride is something we could probably talk about at length and be its own episode. For better or worse, that art is dying in a lot of places in North America. I think a really well-run group ride is tremendous and so much fun and such a learning experience, and not the kind of thing that, you know, yeah, we could wax on about it for an hour and a half, but until you've done it time and time and time again and you see the benefits, then you really are obviously seeing it firsthand. So, I mean, one of my best recommendations is go to your local bike shop and ask about group rides and ask what are the challenging ones, what are the ones that are really conducive to newbies, and you learn all the things that Laura hit on, right? I mean, like, sure, the stronger riders are going to be in the front, and perhaps the people who want to learn about a pace line, you know, you're going to learn where, when, and how to rotate off and be a well-oiled machine moving down the road. Because there's so many goofy little nuances. Like, how do you point something out? What happens when the wind shifts? What happens when you take a corner? What happens when someone gets a flat? I mean, so many little things that are all good conversation pieces. How'd I do?
Good. I mean, I think, yeah, just, it's so nice. Like, there were days where we would have a 12-mile kind of drag to the base of the climb. And to get on the wheels of Ted and our friend Anthony, you're basically, you know, motor pacing, getting those miles done so much more quickly than you would. Yes, is it sometimes uncomfortable? It feels like we start that ride at a pace where, you know, I'd really like to start a little more leisurely. Yeah, I feel like that a lot. But reminding yourself, I'm going to get to the base of the climb faster. We're, you know, reminding yourself that sometimes it takes a good 20 to 30 minutes to really feel good, especially riding day after day in the first place. So I would try not to judge how I was really feeling in the first little bit. Yes, it was. I was just going to kind of expect this will be uncomfortable, but knowing, hey, I'm flying along, and when we get to the bottom of the climb, we can all kind of decide how we want to approach that climb. And there were days where we all tried to climb together, and Jess, my friend Pia, and I were obviously like pushing ourselves really hard to try and stay at what's probably like Ted's endurance or tempo pace. And then there were days where we just knew, hey, it's not our day, and oh, he has intervals too, so let's take it, dial it back. And I think getting to a point where you can really understand what everyone's goals are, and then also self-assess and know when to choose to push yourself. And this is something I feel like I've really honed over the years, because I used to always try to keep up until I was with Ted, until I was like so dead, it was like detrimentally dead, right? Like I'm going to dig myself into an extremely big hole. And that's not fun when you're on a 7-day trip of riding. So just learning to recognize, you know, my own limits and what is going to set me up for success for the 7 days to come. But also finding that line of like where, I mean, it's an amazing tool to have people stronger than you for training. Like, I will go harder than I've ever gone before when I'm riding with these really strong riders than I would do on my own, and even in intervals, because you're just, it's a carrot, right? Like you want to see what's possible. And I think there are a lot of, I discussed it with my girlfriends on the ride, like the mental strategies we've begun to employ to get ourselves just a little bit further, or to kind of like stay on the wheel just a little longer. Cause there were so many points where we're often riding at our breaking point where we're just over threshold and like barely kind of not unsure if we're able to maintain this pace and for how long, and knowing like we still have mountains to climb and quite a bit longer to ride. And it really does, I've noticed there's so much power in just kind of not thinking too far ahead and to breaking it down to thinking literally sometimes it's to just making it to the next corner and knowing that the road is going to bend such that you're going to get just a little break and get in the draft and have a pause to let your heart rate come down for a second. And, you know, just that second can make all the difference in recovering for a minute or for briefly and being able to maintain that high pace again. And so I just think like your mental muscle is sometimes undervalued in how much longer and stronger you can ride with people who are, you know, in a different category from you. And using those people as a tool can be super effective to becoming a stronger cyclist, and just kind of using them, but also knowing your limits and knowing when to kind of not have an ego and to know like, hey, I am not that strong, and I to save myself over these next few days, I think it's going to benefit me to do this climb at a pace where I can like maintain a conversation. So that's those are the tips.
Not competitive at all. Not competitive at
right.
all.
Dude, right.
How about, you're obviously traveling a lot and dropping into new places, and I know that you're often squeezing in rides at odd hours. Do you ever drop in on a group ride and see any particular faux pas or ways to, I mean, you're very knowledgeable. Do you see ways that you can insert a bit of knowledge without, because it's a balance. You don't want to come in and be like, let me tell you how to do this better. But ultimately, that's what people are trying to do, is like try to offer up advice to make everybody else's ride better, more efficient. So what do you see?
Well, I'm not one to like give advice at a group ride when I'm a first timer, but here's my only advice to anybody dropping in, because I do drop in occasionally on a group ride that I know I'm going to do one time. And that is, and I hate to say it, but us as cyclists are not the friendliest people to strangers. And so I'll roll up to a group ride and there'll be eight people in a circle talking, and I could just sit there for 10 minutes by myself and nobody would say a word. And so I just make a discipline of the minute I roll up, I immediately start introducing myself. And it's really uncomfortable, but that would be my advice to every cyclist, whether you're an introvert or an extrovert. Roll up to the group ride. Hey, I'm Stu. First time on the ride. Great to meet you. Tell me your name. Mm-hmm. And then like they're humans. So like 99 times out of 100, people are friendly and go, oh, well, yeah, be careful on the left turn at whatever. There's a bunch of sand in the road. And then everybody's always really nice. But if you don't start the conversation and introduce yourself right out the gate, cyclists, and I hate to say it, but especially road cyclists, tend to be rather unfriendly to newcomers unless it's initiated by the newcomer. And so that's my big advice. Just right out the gate, you know, break the seal and be the one to say hello. And I agree. I just love on those group rides. You just end up putting your head down and having an experience you wouldn't have by yourself. And at least for me, as a total weekend warrior, it just ticks off the miles so much quicker. Mm-hmm. I can go do 2 hours with a buddy and it literally can feel like it was a 35-minute ride. 2 hours by myself can feel like hard work and mental toughness to get through it. So riding with others, especially if you're lacking motivation, when I'm lacking motivation, I just schedule a ride with a friend because I have to show up. You know, he's meeting me at 2 at the Starbucks. So
that's my tactic.
Those are the keys.
It's so helpful to get
what's that?
The door sometime. Just making a plan to meet someone.
Yeah.
I mean, it's for me, I mean, Ted doesn't have this challenge, but on these gray days throughout winter in Vermont, it's really hard to get outside. And so if I made a plan, it will guarantee getting me out the door. I did get an Instagram message while on our trip, and someone commented like, oh, it's so special that you can ride with your partner. And I thought that would be worth bringing up, because I think what I've determined is, yes, it's really special to ride with your partner. I think the grass can also be greener, where you can think, oh, if my partner didn't ride, then I could just do whatever I wanted and I didn't have to accommodate them. And I also could have all the time allocated to myself and not have to split it, right? And then there are other variations of kind of, you know, whether that works or whether it doesn't. So I guess what I wanted to say is, like, I don't think there's any perfect combination of having a partner that rides versus having a partner that doesn't ride. And there are so many variations of, like, whether you're even a good fit to ride together. And, you know, either however it might be for you, there are perks and there are drawbacks, and just kind of like focusing on the positive is probably the best way to do it, rather than what you don't have or what you haven't been able to have. Because I know you probably see a lot of our social media, and it's just like we're always smiling and riding together, but there have been plenty of rides that have ended in tears and plenty of friction from learning how to be better about riding together. And it's a true challenge, no matter what our disparity is or what another partner's disparity is. It's that they all present their challenges.
What's the biggest detriment of riding with your partner?
You're asking me? I may be asking you.
Well, I mean, yeah, I think we got some funny question to the effect of, you guys need to have more, like, it was like, you need to have more spontaneity and controversy in your conversations. And that's what I'm trying to elicit here.
Yeah, the biggest detriment is, for me, throughout the years, has been I ride too hard too often.
It's not a detriment.
It is awesome. A detriment. You dig yourself into a hole, and then especially on these riding vacations, once you get into the hole, you get really tired, which means really emotional, and then really sad that you can't keep up. And it's a spiral, and it's terrible, and it's not fun for anyone on the ride. And I am very pleased that, like, you know, this week that we spent, I think we never got close to that. And I think also it's helpful that there were people to have a group of a variety of riding prowess where it's not just Ted and me riding, right? Like, we have other people that we can have company with. So that's helpful.
Nice.
You guys are so cute. I mean, you're just awesome. And I would imagine, I mean, it would be for me annoying if somebody reached out and said, oh, it must be so nice to be able to ride with your partner. You have it so easy. And, you know, you could be on the other end of that phone thinking, listen, we're just humans trying to work this out. So everybody's got their greener pasture that they think, well, if it was only like Ted and Laura have it, I could ride way more. That's just hogwash.
Exactly. Yep. That was my point. Well, I think we're getting close to wrapping it up. We had one other question from someone who said, I'm going to Mallorca in October. Assuming someone could only do one or two rides there, could Laura and or Ted create, post, or discuss the absolute best, most beautiful route? I'm gonna hand that over to Ted.
I'm curious if it's a literal question. Meaning, if you're going to go all the way to Mallorca and you're only going to ride one or two routes, then actually, this is a really important question. Route or route? I think I say route. What do you guys say?
I think it's potato, potato, isn't it?
Yeah. Laura's been saying route. I didn't know this about you.
Well, we also say orange differently.
Yes, we do. Or orange. Okay, so you're going to Mallorca, and you've wanted two routes. I would suggest going for a longer period of time and bringing your bike and really diving into more rides, but maybe it's because you're going with your spouse and your spouse doesn't want you to ride that much, in which case you're going to be at a bike shop. We did see some, you know, with so many cyclists and such a strong cycling culture, there were a lot of very nice bikes for rent. So that's diving into the minutia, the literal minutia. I would suggest going for a big day, and the mountains are on the northwest corridor of the island, and doing anything that involves Soler, S-O-L-L-E-R, is going to be great. Soler is sort of a jump-off point, and so if you're going to start literally from there, going in any direction is going to be up. A shorter ride would be starting there and going to the north. Sac Labra is a very noteworthy climb that is beautiful. The only way to access it is you actually drop down from the main road down to the down to sea level, and so you're going to be climbing up from there. And I want to say that was a good, like an 8 mile climb, or going huge and going from Soler down to Daya and all the way along the coast. I want to say into Andratx, A-N-D-R-A-T-X, or some crazy Spanish word that I can't pronounce. I mean, go back to what I was doing when I first arrived. The only time I'd been there was a team training camp in 2015. So I spent a lot of time looking at heat maps and what other people had done and what looked popular. And yeah, to Laura's point, looked at elevation gains and distances and said, oh yeah, that's a proper climb. Let's go play around there. So go north, young man or woman.
Well, on that note, the season is about to kick off. Actually, has kicked off. We didn't even get to, both Stu and Ted have already had one race under their belt this season so far, and we're going to discuss that on the next pod. What else are we going to discuss?
Yeah, we got a busy race season kicking into gear. That's very exciting. So we'll dive into some races. We'll talk maybe some race strategy or some ideas on how to have fun at your first race, whether it's your first race of your life or first race of the season. Yeah, I'm excited about that. I love racing. That's what keeps me fired up.
You have Mid-South this weekend.
Oh, yeah. In particular, I did Valley of Tears Gravel in Texas, an inaugural event. Really well run. That was a lot of fun. We'll dive into those details next episode. And then, yeah, Mid-South. Oh, I'm making a video about it because it was quite the back-to-back-to-back. I went from the American Birkebeiner Nordic Ski Race to Mallorca to Texas Gravel Race. So that was a tough one to pack for, and maybe that explains why I have this head cold. But yeah, now home for 3 days and about to go off to Mid-South. So no rest for the weary.
And then you guys are both coming out west, my direction, for Levi's Grand Fondo.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, in Seattle. And I think we're going to get to meet up in person and maybe have a beer and record a live podcast.
That's the word on the street.
Maybe we can organize a Gravel King shakeout ride or something.
Whoa.
Oh, I love that.
It's already I love that. Don't overload our schedule.
Do the Healdsburg loop or something, right? That'd be great.
Well, time's sake, I think we should.
I think it's a great plan.
Well, on that note, I'm gonna bid you farewell for the night. I wish you a fun time in, was it North Dakota, South Dakota? Which Dakota are you in?
I'm in North Dakota.
Nice. You know, truth be told, we drove across the country and loved North Dakota. Remember that? Because we went from North Dakota, and with all due respect to Eastern Montana makes North Dakota look stunning. And it was.
Yeah.
And then Eastern Montana.
North Dakota's gorgeous.
Fields and fields and fields for 1,500 miles. Anyway, yeah, safe travels to you home, and hope the trip is successful in North Dakota, and look forward to catching up in, what, probably a week and change's time.
Can't wait.
Thanks, too. We'll talk to you later.
Night-night.